Support for the Capital Connection comes from
United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is an old friend, Jesse McKinley, a Metro correspondent for the New York Times with an emphasis on coverage of upstate New York. Jesse McKinley previously served as bureau chief in Albany and San Francisco, California, as well as stints as a feature writer, theater columnist, and Broadway reporter for the Culture Desk. It's been a while. Welcome back, Jesse. It's great to have you here.
Alan, it's lovely to be here.
Okay, so the last time we spoke, the governor was Andrew Cuomo. Remember him? A lot has changed.
I do.
A lot has changed since then, including the first elected female governor of New York, Kathy Hochul. She just released a $227 billion state budget, and we're awaiting budget proposals from the Senate and Assembly next week. So how's Hochul doing, or doing, if you were speaking proper English? Give us a sense of what we can expect from the coming budget negotiations.
Well, I think to answer your first question, it depends on who you talk to as to how Governor Hochul is doing. I think most of the polls that I've seen since the beginning of the year have actually shown her to be pretty buoyant. You know, her favorability is about, you know, in the 40s, her likability or job approval, so to speak, is about that, if not a little bit higher. So just in terms of the electorate, I think she's doing pretty well. In terms of her relationship with the legislature, however, that has been fraught. And I think that you can kind of pin a lot of this on the LaSalle nomination for the top court, for the Court of Appeals. Hector LaSalle was proffered as the potential chief judge for the Court of Appeals in late December. The legislature, led by mainly progressives, but some moderates as well, Democrats, said no, and said no resoundingly, not only in a committee vote, but in kind of a longer drawn out battle over his nomination, which ended up with a full Senate vote in which LaSalle was rejected. So, in terms of her personal relationship right now with the legislature, I think it's tense and probably just a touch icy. But as you mentioned, we are entering into budget season in which the rubber kind of meets the road. You know, this is a gigantic budget, $230-some-odd billion, one of the biggest in the United States, I think second only to California. And there's a lot of money to go around, but there's also a lot of priorities. And the question will be in the weeks before the April 1st deadline is whether or not the governor, who has outsized power in these negotiations, is able to get her way, or if the legislature once again decides to flex the muscles and try to push her in a different direction.
So what is the problem? I mean, what's between the two groups, you know, the governor and the legislature, that is creating chaos?
Well, it's a funny situation. You know, I think in other states, generally, you know, standoffs between the legislature and a chief executive involve party designations. You know, you either have a Republican legislature that doesn't want to give anything to a Democratic governor or vice versa. New York, of course, is different. You know, both the Assembly and the Senate have supermajorities of Democrats. Kathy Hochul is a Democrat. They all go to the same parties. They all wear blue, so to speak, and they conceivably would all be on the same page. But what you're saying here is kind of a tension between the moderate part of the party, as represented by Governor Hochul, and an ascendant and emboldened progressive wing of the party, which is rising not only in the Senate, where they would probably count, I don't know, 12, 15 members in that kind of loose caucus, as well as in the Assembly, which is a much larger legislative body, obviously 150 members, but also has a growing number of younger, by and large, more progressive members who have a more liberal worldview. And I think that's the tension you're seeing of kind of progressive slash more liberal legislators wanting, you know, their priorities, which include things like criminal justice reform, which include things like, affordable housing, things like, equity for all peoples, all of which Governor Hochul would also voice support for, but in a lot of ways they have different goals. And I think the most kind of stark example of this is public safety, where the bail reform law of a couple of years ago has been hailed by a lot of young progressives as a way to kind of make policing more equitable and make crime and punishment more equitable. But for, mainstream Democrats like Kathy Hochul and, on up the food chain to national Democrats, has become a problematic political issue. Bail reform did not play well with voters in suburban and rural counties in New York State, as evidenced by the 2022 election cycle.
Too progressive?
Well, it's not up to me to say whether it's too progressive or not, but I will say that the issue of crime was a big issue that a lot of Republicans ran hard on. And, as evidenced at least by the congressional races where they flipped four seats, seemingly ran successfully on this idea that Democrats had been too lenient on criminals and that as a result, the streets were less safe. And, you hear that rhetoric even coming out of City Hall in New York City, where Mayor Adams has made a point of calling for more reforms to the bail reform law to make it more strict and to allow judges more discrepancy.
That's interesting because, Adams is a guy who knows a lot about police and has talked about all of this. Why does he come down that way?
Well, I think part of it is, his background, as you mentioned, he is a former police officer, but also it's a political calculation. Crime has always been an issue that New York City politicians live and die by. I mean, you don't have to go far. Very far back, Rudy Giuliani, before he went completely MAGA, was a guy who ran on kind of basic law and order platform, a former prosecutor, a guy that was going to, rein in the chaos in New York City in the 1990s and was successful running on that politically. So it's always been an issue for New York City mayors, and Mayor Adams is no different. He ran on, in part, a law and order platform and got elected. And so now he's trying to make good on those pledges. And part of making good on those pledges is, diverging from progressives on the issue of bail reform.
We're talking with Jesse McKinley of the New York Times. So, Jesse, what is your sense of what has happened with Hector LaSalle? We have talked a little bit about that here, but who is Hector LaSalle and why is he so important?
Well, the job that he was nominated for is the most important job in the state judiciary. It is chief judge of the Court of Appeals, which for those who don't follow these things, and I certainly did not follow these things until I was paid to follow these things.
Right.
But the Court of Appeals is the highest court in New York State. It's basically our Supreme Court, which of course is confusing because New York also has a Supreme Court, but that's a lower court, but we'll leave that for a different conversation. But Hector LaSalle was up for the most important job in New York State's judiciary. It's not only a job in which you have to put on your judge hat and, be one of seven top judges in the state, but you also have to basically administer this sprawling court system, right, which is in every city and every county and every part of the state. And it's a big job. And Hector LaSalle had this kind of very admirable judicial resume. He had a compelling personal history, and yet he got caught up in a nomination process in which particularly progressives, but as I said before, some moderates and certainly some labor groups were concerned about a couple of decisions that seemed to fall on the more conservative side of of the political spectrum. Mr. LaSalle would contest that and say that that wasn't true, but it became a political football, and he got rejected by not only the committee, the Judiciary Committee, but then also by the full Senate.
What was going on there? I mean, this really began to stink of some real animus. Was there something I was missing?
I think, in fact, this does predate Hector LaSalle. I think this goes back to the 2022 cycle when Democrats, hoping to kind of hold on to not only a number of congressional seats, but potentially pick up congressional seats in the 2022 cycle, drew congressional lines that would have, by some estimations, allowed them to win three or four additional seats, which, as we now know, is the margin in House of Representatives.
The whole House of Representatives.
Exactly. So this seemed to be this very clever plan by New York Democrats to, for lack of a better word, gerrymander some of these districts so that they would win more seats. Now, those lines were thrown out by a judge as a result of a Republican-led lawsuit. And then that case ended up at the Court of Appeals, the top court in New York State. And they upheld the lower court's decision and forced those lines to be redrawn. And flash forward to last November, Republicans actually won four seats statewide. And once again, what's the margin in the House of Representatives? Four seats. So you know, hindsight's 20/20. But for a lot of people, it looked like by extension, the court decision in New York resulted in Republicans winning the House of Representatives. Now, of course, there's a lot of steps that went into that. There were a lot of races. You know, some races were won by very small margins. Democrats had big hopes to win these seats back in a couple of years. But there was a lot of blame to go around as to why the Democrats lost the House of Representatives, and a large part of it seemed to fall on the New York State Court of Appeals. So when Hector LaSalle was nominated to lead this, there was intense scrutiny on his record because I think that redistricting decision really upset a lot of Democrats. And of course, Democrats are in charge of the state Senate and thus in charge of saying yay or nay to Hector LaSalle. So I think he got caught in that kind of those crosswinds.
So let's talk about Long Island Congressman and fabulous George Santos. What's going on there?
Never heard of him. No, I'm just kidding. The George Santos story, which I would note was first given great light and depth by my colleagues Grace Ashford and Michael Gold, who have just done a bang-up job on the story since the beginning, is one of the great political mysteries / stem winders that I've ever encountered. You know, George Santos obviously was elected to the 3rd Congressional District in Long Island and turns out to be just completely full of it, for lack of a better word. You know, he has lied about everything from the fact that he, you know, attended prestigious universities to the fact he held prestigious jobs to the fact that he was raising money for dogs and apparently earlier this week was complaining that he had to feed his fish and apparently he did not have fish. This was all in housing court. You can look it up. As crazy as it sounds, it's all true. The man lied about whether or not he had fish. So, leaving all of that aside, he is still a member of Congress, and as near as anyone can tell, there are very little mechanisms beyond another election in 2024 to remove him from Congress, despite the fact that in a day and age of hyperpartisanship, everyone seems to want George Santos gone, not only Democrats who have been chuckling and laughing about this for months now, but also Republicans who find him to be an embarrassment, particularly on Long Island, where Republicans showed quite a bit of strength in 2022. Guys like Joe Cairo, who is the Nassau County GOP chair and, you know, was credited with running a lot of successful races. This has been a huge black mark on their record because how did this guy get elected? How was he not vetted more closely? And to be honest, the Democrats didn't vet him particularly carefully either. You know, in the political biz, there's obviously a phrase called OPPO, which stands for opposition research. And apparently the OPPO on George Santos didn't get done to the extent that they didn't realize this guy was just a complete fabulist. So,
well,
this is the story that just keeps on giving.
Well, doesn't this reflect badly on your profession, on the press, not having caught him in the lies and the other stuff that he's been doing?
I would push back on that. I think that, you know, there were 26 congressional races in New York last fall. We covered a lot of them pretty closely. I know that I wrote about it, a half dozen of them at least. Some of the vetting of these candidates was probably closer than or tighter than others. But by the same token, I think we did a pretty good job of covering the races. Now, hindsight, once again, is 2020, and I'm sure that there are criticisms to be lobbed as to whether or not, George Santos in particular was given a tough enough scrubbing. But, you know, I would push back pretty strong that the press somehow fell out on the job. And quite frankly, since Grace Ashford and Michael Gold did this digging post-election, the level of scrutiny on George Santos has been extreme and excellent, you know, not only from my newspaper, The New York Times, but from publications up and down our ranks.
So where does Elise Stefanik, the upstate congresswoman, come into all of this?
Well, it's an interesting question. Elise was an early backer of George Santos as early as, I believe, August of 2021. I believe she either endorsed him or held a kind of online fundraiser with him where, you know, they kind of twinned their accounts basically raise money through the same platform. She has been remarkably silent on this. We have tried to pin her down. Grace Ashford, in fact, found her at an event a couple of weeks ago and tried to get a straight answer as to her feelings about George Santos. Elise was not particularly forthcoming. Last time I checked, although it's been a little while, you know, George Santos had Elise Stefanik on his Twitter page, you know, saying, Elise Stefanik endorses me. So there was a lot of connective tissue between, at least his campaigning and saying that Elise was one of his big supporters and Elise herself. Now, Elise, of course, would say, oh, no, I didn't know much about this, blah, blah, blah. But obviously, you know, success has a million brothers and failure, you die alone or however it goes. But now that George Santos is very much on the outs, you know, people are holding him at arm's length, if not more than arm's length. It will be curious to see whether or not he continues to have this kind of stigma around him, or if, as you know, the months and year passes, if, you know, somehow he manages to ingratiate himself to people in that wing of the Republican Party, that MAGA wing of the Republican Party, which he seems to have already made efforts to do. So, you know, time will tell.
So CPAC is the annual conference for conservative lawmakers. Where does that all come into this?
Well, it's interesting. I did not cover that, but I watched it from afar. You know, Elise did give a speech down there. There's, in the same way that we were talking before about the kind of divide in the Democratic ranks, obviously there's a divide in Republican ranks. And last week, Nick Fandos and I wrote about, the battle for the state party chair in New York and how that basically does represent, you know, somewhat of a schism between more traditional Democrats, or rather more traditional Republicans like Edward Cox, who looks like he's coming back to be state party chair, and more firebrands like Elise Stefanik and others of her ilk who believe in this kind of Trumpy, more right-wing rhetoric. So Elise falls firmly in Donald Trump's camp. She's already endorsed him for president in 2024. She endorsed Carl Paladino in a Western New York congressional race. And Carl Paladino, for those of you without Wikipedia readily available, is the former gubernatorial candidate from 2010 who has said a series of just despicable, sexist, racist, homophobic things over the years. And yet, despite that, Elise endorsed him to run for Congress in a June primary last year. So, you know, there is a divide on the right in New York and nationwide between people that still think that Donald Trump is the bee's knees and people that feel that the Republican Party should probably bank back towards the center a little bit and try to win some national elections.
Okay, so you are the Metro correspondent for the New York Times. Talk to us about the MTA. New York State Comptroller DiNapoli has said there's still a lack of clarity on how the MTA will close its $600 million deficit. So what's that all about?
Well, that is part of the budget negotiations that are going to be coming up. I mean, you know, one of the proposals in Governor Hochul's January budget presentation was to basically try to, I believe the exact turn of phrase she had was avoid the fiscal cliff that the MTA is facing. But obviously, you know, public transit is a enormously important element of not only New York City, but also kind of regional recovery from COVID. You know, the idea right now in many corporate boardrooms is that they need to get people back to the office. And in part and parcel of getting people back to the office is getting people back on trains and buses to get into the city. So, you know, this is one of these, the MTA is not only important for, you know, getting people from A to B, but it's also kind of one of these vital things that trickles down into a number of different sectors, including real estate, which, as you know, is one of the most important, industries in New York and New York and in the New York region. So saving the MTA, it's not only a transportation issue, it's kind of a regional recovery issue. And I think Hochul recognizes that. And I think they'll probably get a pretty robust package done in March. But obviously, it is a pressing problem, as evidenced by the idea of a fiscal cliff.
So they go into a room and they talk to each other and they come out and they say, okay, we got this solved.
That's what they say. They say they've got it solved. Whether they've got it solved, time will tell again.
So now let's talk about the rollout of New York State's legalized adult recreational marijuana market. It's taken a long time. What's going on?
Well, you know, the marijuana in New York have had a kind of fraught relationship over the years. You know, you'll recall that even getting a medical marijuana program up it took a little while. We were behind other states on that. And recreational, I think, has followed suit. You know, for their credit, OCM, which is the Office of Cannabis Management, I think gets pretty good reviews from people in that industry for its leadership. But keep in mind, it is still been a pretty cautious rollout. And, you know, whereas other states like Massachusetts, which is the home state, of course, of Alan Chertok.
I was going to say.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you go to Great Barrington, there's a ton of weed shops, and most of them are very finely appointed, I would say. And in New York City, even before the actual, you know, legalized places opened up, they ran into a problem in that a lot of, you know, just empty storefronts got filled up by people selling weed. And their argument was, oh, well, it's, you know, weed is legal now, so I guess it's legal to sell. Of course, that wasn't true. But when you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of illegal storefronts selling marijuana, it was a pretty high task to ask the NYPD to go in and bust all of those people. And, you know, there was legal confusion about it, too, you know, where, you know, because it was legal to possess small amounts and smoke small amounts, you know, I think the police in New York City were kind of caught flat-footed and didn't quite know what to do. And, you know, I think Adams has struggled and scrambled to try to address that. And some of these places have been raided and shut down. But, you know, the horse head was kind of already out of the barn. And so now the state is dealing with, you know, a kind of open black market in marijuana, as at the same time that they're trying to set up a legal market for marijuana. So it's a complicated situation and one that's not going to resolve itself quickly. And then also there's the issue of taxes. And, you know, I've heard this from younger people that I know who are pot aficionados who say, look, you know, I could certainly go to a legal place and buy, you know, something, you know, a gram or whatever. And yet if I go to an illegal place, it's going to be cheaper. Or if I go back to the guy who I was always buying for when it wasn't legal, he's going to be cheaper. So they've got kind of an almost economic issue there, too, that the taxes that the state is levying make the price go higher. And as a result, they're probably losing a little market share to people that don't want to pay a higher price and will just go back to the people they were buying from before.
New York City Mayor Adams has created a 24/7 arrival center to handle migrants as numbers swell. Meanwhile, the mayor announced a shift in policy on asylum seekers that includes a more formal process in resettling migrants throughout the state and other cities across the country. Seems like this problem will continue to grow. You're covering it for The Times, I guess. And what are you finding?
Well, I think in part, you know, once again, to go back to kind of the theme of this conversation, there's a practical consideration, which is the kind of humane treatment of people that are fleeing terrible situations, particularly in Latin and Central America, trying to make new lives, trying to find safe haven, and a political problem for Mayor Adams and other political leaders in rising fears, sometimes stoked by hysterical coverage from the right, of open borders and people flooding across and drugs and sex trafficking and all terrible things that are associated with some of this. Politically, I think Adams is once again trying to kind of bank to the center on this and say, you know, we have processes to help these people, but I'm also cognizant that it's an issue for some people as well to kind of have open borders, etc. One interesting thing that I've been looking at too, is that people like Elise Stefanik and Claudia Tenney, who's a conservative congresswoman from Central New York, have been trying in recent weeks to say, look, the southern border is a problem, but the northern border is also a problem. And sure enough, if you look at statistics from federal agencies, there have been more migrants coming across the northern border as well. And it pales in comparison to what has happened along the border with Mexico. But it will be interesting to me to see if Republicans can make the northern border, our border with Canada, at several locations, obviously, and whether they can make the northern border a political issue as well.
So that's it for this week's Capital Connection. We are delighted that we convinced Jesse McKinley to come in and talk to us from the New York Times. Jesse, you're always welcome here. Thanks so much.
Alan, anytime. Thanks so much.
Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us online anytime at WAMC.org or just schedule a podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. Thanks for listening.